Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to present some of my work at this great conference here. In fact, it's such a great conference that you guys stole all of my thunder. About 80% of the talks so far are directly relevant for detection of light scale or dark matter. So I decided, instead of talking an hour about this, to break it into two parts and sort of summarize in a dark matter context the capabilities of these four technologies that I think are most promising to look for very light scalers. And then spend the majority of my talk talking about a new proposal to look for not just light scalers, so these are CP even scalers, but any dark matter boson. So a scalar, a pseudoscalar, or a new vector at the second half of the talk. So Mina started off with an excellent theory overview of light scalars and other dark matter candidates. And then Ed talked about atomic clocks, and Michael, we just heard about mechanical resonators. And I think tomorrow, Luca will talk about mechanical resonators as well. And interferometry was covered in three talks so far, and accelerometers and short distance gravity measurements with it has been covered in three talks so far, and Eric will give another one. So I've written three proposals using the first three classes of technology with people in the room, including Jinwu here, Mina and Savas, and then I did an experimental analysis with the Butker group. So instead of summarizing all of the technologies, I'll put it into a dark matter context and maybe review some of the theory. But just to zoom out for a second, the standard model of particle physics accurately describes every known experiment and observation to date, at least to the precision that we can measure and calculate. Now, that's a very loaded statement, because by describe comes with an asterisk. We've parameterized some of our ignorance into a couple of numbers and some unspecified forms of matter, like dark matter, and some initial conditions. Sorry, this is a problem, not a parameterized unknown. And so as theorists, we can do a variety of things. We can think about new mathematical structures and see if they're realized in nature, explain some small numbers like the Higgs mass or the value of the dark energy, or just compute things more precisely. But really, I think we should push on the experimental frontier. Historically, these guys, so all the new particles and forces have been found at the high energy frontier. The cosmic frontier has told us about dark matter in particular, and some things about inflation and dark energy. But there's a wide open area to push the frontier sort of at the tabletop level, at the intensity frontier, looking for very rare events, or at the precision frontier, looking for very small effects with precise instruments. And in particular, so you can look for dark matter at the intensity and precision frontier. So what types of dark matter can you look for? If dark matter is a fermion, it's already been said, it has to be, this is mass in EV from 10 to the minus 33 EV to 60 orders of magnitude higher to 10 to the 27 EV. Mina already reviewed part of this. But if it's a fermion, it has to be heavier than the KeV. But if it's lighter, then it has to be a boson. And in fact, it can be as light as about 10 to the minus 21 EV, the fuzzy dark matter limit. And so on this energy scale, I've also put the equivalent Compton wavelength of the dark matter particle, as well as the time scale associated with it, with this length scale. And so you can see that for things below 1 EV, the Compton wavelength becomes macroscopic. Here it's 100 meters, and here it's about the size of here it's roughly, the Compton wavelength is the distance to the nearest star. And the time scale as well. So this time scale would be the oscillation of the dark matter wave. And around here, it's about 1 year. So because the distance to the nearest star is about 1 light year. And here, it's in this region, it's sort of on the frequency scale that we can access with resonators. Like Michael's mechanical resonator was in this megahertz to gigahertz regime, for example. And so the first part of the talk will be in this energy regime with using macroscopic resonators to look for light scale or dark matter. And then the second part of the talk will be around the EV scale to use the highest frequency resonators that can exist in nature, or some of the highest frequency resonators, namely atoms and molecules. And the reason why you would like to do resonant experiments is that the dark matter, bosonic dark matter in particular, constitutes a very monochromatic signal or a narrowband signal. The reason is that dark matter is non-relativistic. So its kinetic energy is subleading to its rest mass energy. So in many ways, you can think of a dark matter wave as a laser with a small 10 to the minus 6 fractional frequency spread. Okay, so Meenert reviewed some of these things already. So it's a wave that's oscillating at the with a frequency set by the mass for a vector, a scalar, or a pseudoscalar, and it's a narrowband perturbation. So if I plot the power spectrum of this wave, here it's order 1, but I've sort of cut off a lot of this. So it's really almost a delta function in frequency space. And as Mina also mentioned already, so if such a light weakly coupled field exists in the theory, it's very difficult for it not to be produced in the early universe. In particular, a spin 1 vector naturally comes out if you have large scale inflation. So during the inflationary era, the field is perturbed and it gets jiggled around, and it can in a calculable way you can measure you can predict the abundance today, and it comes out right if it has the right mass, and likewise there's a similar mechanism for a spin zero particle, and so there's a variety of candidates, and so one such candidate is that of a hidden photon, and that's sort of the easiest to think about because it interacts just like our regular photon, except, so this is the electromagnetic current. This is this new 4 vector that's similar to the normal 4 vector. And then the interaction is just rescaled by a dimensionless number epsilon. And so to give you an idea of the size of what this vector potential is, if you rewrite this Lagrangian operator in terms of a non-relativistic Hamiltonian, this just induces the normal electric dipole transitions rescaled by epsilon. And this electric field of this dark matter laser, so to speak, is extremely intense. So it's a 3 kilovolts per meter, which you can calculate from this number here. And so to give you an idea, that's equivalent to one of those weapons on US destroyers. So if you thought looking at the eclipse was bad, if epsilon were 1, looking at the dark matter would be really bad. But epsilon is already constrained as a function of mass, and it's tiny. But because this field is so intense, you have some hope of detecting tiny interactions. Okay, so don't get freaked out by this equation here. What I wanted to illustrate here is that you can parameterize the interactions just like Dima did for an axion. So it's a free scalar field, pretty much. And then you can classify the most relevant operators at low energies. So you can interact, phi can interact with photons, it can interact with gluons, electrons, or quarks. What you notice is that all the relevant operators at low energies look like if phi changes, if the value of phi changes, it would look like the value of here, for example, the fine structure constant changes. And likewise, I've written the other operators in a way that if phi changes and it couples to gluons, then it would change the proton mass, for example, or the electron and quark masses. So the basic phenomenology is that if this light scalar field exists in the theory, is that masses like the electron mass and the fine structure constant would no longer be constant. They would no longer be fundamental constants of the theory, but they would be space and time dependent as phi varied in time and space. If it were dark matter, or if it's sourced in the lab, or by the solar system, for example. Amin already talked about it, the scalar can arise in a variety of ways. So it can couple to the Higgs. The QCD axion already has this coupling. It arises in theories with extra dimensions, or other ones as well.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
In the previous talk, it was with these phonon waves.
Mm-hmm.
They said it was setting the limit on m changing of the mass. But why isn't alpha also affecting the spring constant of the oscillator?
It is. So you could actually do parametric, if you change the spring constant enough, you could do parametric resonance.
Right, but how do you set a limit on M sub E if what you're actually measuring is the frequency, which is had to do with the square root of M over K, if you like it?
So there are degeneracies where you know, if you pick this coefficient and tune it against this one, that you have no effect. There's actually multiple effects. So Michael, with his resonators, can measure the value of alpha if alpha were to change slowly, for example. But a more sensitive way for him to do the experiment is if the frequency of the dark matter wave matches one of his acoustic frequencies of his quartz resonator, for example. And then it looks like I'll get to it. Then it looks like a scalar gravitational wave.
But can I say something?
Yeah.
Eric measured parametric resonance.
Yes.
Parametric resonance does not happen generically, right?
Because the amplitude is small.
Yes. So the point about parametric resonance, for it to happen, you require that the variation of the frequency is larger than 1 over Q.
No.
So for this, the fractional variation of these parameters in the Young modulus that change the frequency of the object is much smaller than that. So parametric resonance does not happen here.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking about parametric resonance.
Oh, okay.
I was thinking about degeneracy.
Yes, there is.
There are degeneracies.
As you
yes.
said, there is degeneracy.
Yes.
Yeah.
In most of the things. Just like if you look for...
So it's wrong to think of this as a one-dimensional constraint on the variation of...
Yes,
mass.
Yes.
No, yes, exactly.
Yes, yes. So it's really...
100% correlated.
Right.
Yes.
I would argue it's at least four-dimensional. I mean, and there's many quarks. So it's a multi-dimensional parameter space. When I'll talk about limits, I'll assume that only one coupling is non-zero, but you're absolutely right. It's a multi-dimensional parameter space. Yes. Okay. So what are the physical effects of space-time dependent masses and couplings? And so I think the three principal ones are the fact that energies functionally depend on all of the constants, of course, and if the constants vary in time and space, then so do clock frequencies. So in atoms, for example, this means you can look for these effects with some of the atomic clocks that we heard about, or interferometers. If now say the atomic cloud ticks at a different rate, if a left atomic cloud ticks at a different rate as a right atomic cloud. Likewise, the size of objects, so the size of a table, for example, is set by just an integer, the number of latticites, times the Bohr radius. And so if the Bohr radius changes as a function of time, because alpha and ME change in time, then you can acoustically excite an object like one of Michael's resonators, or a Weber bar, or any solid. And then finally, a third effect is to look for spatial gradients in fine structure constants, because spatial gradients, either coming from a spatially varying dark matter wave or by some source you've put in the lab produce potential gradients and thus accelerations and forces that you can look for with accelerometers like torsion balances, like optically levitated microspheres, etc. Any questions about this? So those are the three principal effects, and we've heard about these four technologies. So I will just show the parameter spaces to just summarize them. And the conclusion will be not that one technology is better than others. In fact, those four different classes are complementary because each of them can test different couplings at different masses, and some are directional effects and some are not. So here I've plotted as a function of mass, so all the way from this fuzzy dark matter limit to higher energies, so this is 10 to the minus 4 eV, this coupling. So this is a coupling to electrons on a log scale, so this is a gravitational strength coupling. This is 10 to the minus 5 times gravity. So I'll explain what this all means. So these are tests of the inverse square law of gravity. So assume that you have no composition dependence. These are just deviations from 1 over r squared. Like what Giorgio was talking about, Pioneer would test these long range modifications here. The short distance gravity measurements at the micron scale would be on this side of the plot. And then I think Eric will talk about equivalence principle violation tests, and Mark has already talked about it. So the current best bound by Eric's experiments constrain this coupling, for example, if all of the other ones are zero, to be 10 to the minus 2, the strength of gravity. And these two bounds are independent of the dark matter abundance. That's just you source it in the solar system or in the lab. Clocks, for example, so a cesium clock compared to an optical clock, like one of Ed Marty's clocks, could constrain a lot more of the parameter space at low frequencies if it is a significant fraction of dark matter. Some of the futuristic versions could even do better. This quartz plot here is Michael's piezoelectric resonators that could probe some of this natural parameter space. And there's other resonators at lower frequencies based on Weber bar technology that could even, that could probe this intermediate range. I believe Jason Hogan already talked about atom interferometry. That would, again, cover this intermediate range, especially the space-based proposals would do extremely well. And so you see it's very complementary, all of these technologies. Likewise, for the coupling to photons, you can make a similar plot, so all of these things are roughly the same. And in this case, there's already a clock limit set, an experimental data analysis that I did with Dima. This one here, it's already been superseded by a group in Paris. And I think Ed showed a future projection. I think Ed can already achieve this sensitivity if he compares the frequency of his clock to the frequency of his cavity. I think the noise at lower frequencies would be worse, but with two different atomic clocks, they could get close, I think, to this curve. So that was just putting it into context. You can look for other couplings as well. If there are no questions, I'll continue.
Can you say a word about the natural DE region?
Oh, yes. Let me talk about this one. So scalars infamously have hierarchy problems, right? For example, the Higgs, if there's states heavier than the Higgs, normally the Higgs mass would want to be at the same scale as this new physics. This scalar also has a hierarchy problem, but at a much lower scale. So here I'm assuming that the mass is way below other particle physics scales, even though it couples to heavier particles, in this case the electron. So normally the mass would be So if it is strongly coupled, then the mass would be tuned. It would be unnatural for this particle to be this light. But if it's sufficiently weakly coupled for a low enough cutoff of the theory, the parameter space is untuned in this green region. There are some caveats to this. And so on this line, you can be natural for a cutoff of 10 TeV, which is an energy scale we have not probed yet in particle physics. So it's this diagram. So if this Feynman diagram, so if this is phi, there could be a loop of electrons. If you cut this off at 10 TeV, this gives you a mass correction to phi. And I'm requiring that this not be larger than the physical mass that I've assumed. Yeah, and here I also put the QCD, the monopole coupling of the QCD accent to electrons, but that's extremely tiny, and definitely not the best way to look for it. All right, any other questions about light scalars? I hope that was useful.
By the way,
yes.
This is also model dependent. It makes the assumptions that the cutoff in the loop is 10 TeV.
Right.
Which is not the case, for example, for the QCD axion.
Exactly, yes.
If the QCD axion were a bad solution to the strong CP problem for any reason, the cutoff in the loop would be 100 MeV, and those lines would be moved up by 10 orders of magnitude. So, and indeed, this is the way we view it now, this is a very conservative assumption about what you'd assume
This is assuming phi is a point particle, and this coupling does not have form factors up to 10 TeV. And like Mina said, the QCD axion would have a form factor at the QCD scale, and phi could be a composite particle, for example, too. So there are theories where this line is too pessimistic, and actually, yeah. Right. Okay. Any other questions? If not, then I will talk about part two, which is more exciting to me because it's newer. It's also preliminary work with Mina and Savas. And so hopefully, since the audience is mostly experimentalists, we get some good feedback. So I've arranged this part of the talk into three sections. So at my own risk, I'll review the two-level system in front of you guys. There are some differences from normally we think of driving a two-level system with a laser, which is a relativistic wave, but there are some differences or peculiarities if you excite it with a non-relativistic wave, such as dark matter. And then I'll talk about the experimental setup we have in mind to look for this peculiar signature, and then I'll show sensitivity curves. And so just keep in mind, unlike the previous bit, which was just talking about scalars, this resonant absorption experiment would be sensitive to spin one particles, CP even scalars and CP odd pseudoscalars in the EV range, roughly. And the punchline will be, so we're doing resonant absorption of dark matter with molecules. And so why is this good? The punchline is that it's a very tunable detector. Just like ADMX is tunable in frequency space, and there's a lot of handles. A molecular gas has a lot of handles. So you can tune the atomic lines. There are selection rules involved in the transitions that are not necessarily the same as for normal absorption. I'll talk about that. So first the two-level system. Okay, so I'll assume here this is the ground state zero, some excited state one. That's metastable and can fluoresce to photons at some rate gamma naught with some energy splitting omega naught. And I assume dark matter for now is an external field that's perturbing my atom, and that can cause transitions from the ground state to the excited state with some non-relativistic Hamiltonian delta H. And I can characterize the strength of this off-diagonal matrix element with a Rabi frequency omega, and delta H is oscillating at omega, which is roughly the dark matter mass. Okay, so the idea is, so ground and excited level, dark matter is a non-relativistic plane wave to a good approximation. And if omega, which is set by the mass, matches this energy splitting, I can get resonant absorption. So this looks like this. If I start in the ground state in the interaction picture, I time evolve with this operator. And unlike Jason, I don't quite apply pi over 2 pulse. But it's a little bit smaller. It's this Rabi frequency. And if I'm exactly on resonance, this big fraction here would just be time. So here I see the benefit of being on resonance, right? So this is greatly enhanced if the dark matter perturbation matches the splitting.
An extended source, or extended medium, mm-hmm. you have a phase matching problem. It's not going to be coherent. Because the wavelength of the photon is so much greater than the wavelength of the dark matter problem.
Smaller,
right. Numbers.
Yeah, the wavelength is, this has a large
you're
spatial.
You're showing it nicely in your picture. So it's called a phase matching issue. You have an extended target, if you like. You don't get coherent effects throughout the thing.
I'll talk about coherent effects later. This is just one atom so far. So
right.
It's
I'm assuming now you're going to have a bunch of these two levels.
Yes. And so, I mean, even just for one system, I don't quite leave the full state of the atom unperturbed if I absorb a dark matter particle and then fluoresce a photon, because now the momenta don't quite match, so my atom has picked up some momentum.
And that momentum is what keeps it being coherent if you have a large crystal, for example.
Sure.
I don't get the coherent production over the crystal. I mean, I don't get the naive amount of it.
I'm not understanding.
Because you're giving a moment. The atoms have to absorb some momentum, so they're distinguishable.
The momentum kick that the atom gets is extremely tiny.
It's a matter of principle.
I don't think it's a problem, but maybe afterwards we can discuss. The absorption rate is given by just the number of molecules I have, this Rabi frequency squared, divided by I should call it times T2 normally, and so I've defined T2 by some inverse rate gamma here, times a line shape which I've taken to be Lorentzian, and roughly speaking. This inverse T2, or just this, the width of the absorption line, is given by the radiative width, the larger of the radiative width, the collisional width, and the width of the spectral width of my perturbation.
Okay. Now,
yes.
We don't know what dark matter is. We don't know whether it can be observed in the two-level system. So how do you?
We don't know the dark matter mass. Yeah, and it would be an extreme coincidence if the dark matter matched any line.
Other than that, but I thought the dark matter is almost by definition it doesn't interact with.
Yes.
Only by gravity.
Yes.
Interacts.
Yes. No. Not necessarily. It can interact differently. Okay. If it interacts only with gravity, then we'll look for a long time. I'm hoping that it interacts with something other than gravity.
Something
yes.
Like
yes.
Assumption.
Yeah. And it yes, it's an assumption. If dark matter doesn't couple, we cannot detect it. But you're right. I mean, to a first approximation, it only couples with gravity. So this omega will be tiny. This omega will scale roughly. This omega here will scale roughly like the coupling times square root of the density. And the coupling is already constrained from other tests, typically. Okay. So the radiative width is given by the fact that I can decay back to the ground state or potentially to some intermediate states here with partial widths gamma I. This coherence factor I'll explain later. Take it to be one for now. If I have many molecules, so in a big volume, they can collide with each other. And collisions typically scramble the phases. In particular, I'll scramble the phase of my state relative to the dark matter wave. So this cuts off the resonance, which is why this enters here. An interesting fact is that the Doppler width for absorbing a non-relativistic particle is much smaller than the Doppler width of photon absorption. So normally, this Doppler width is given by roughly this delta omega Doppler is given by the momentum of the photon dotted into the molecular velocity. A similar expression, you have the same expression for dark matter, except k is much smaller than a photon at the same energy. So this is this Doppler width is a fractional width of 10 to the minus 9 or smaller, which is cool. Any further questions about this? So this is the peculiar bit. Yes?
I'm a bit confused. So this is sort of a Fermi golden rule. Dark
yes. Yes.
So there are then assumptions about the frequency of the field versus the rate at which this transition is happening, right?
The frequency.
So.
Yeah, this is the time averaged. This is the time averaged rate after long times of integration.
Long compared to what?
The time averaged absorption rate long compared to gamma. Long compared to inverse gamma.
So the omega, so the frequency of the driving field must also somehow matter.
The frequency? Yes. The frequency. So I'm thinking about EV waves, right? Roughly speaking, EV scale energies. So this will be on the order of these energies are on the order of an EV.
It's a hockey stick for those of us that can't see that color.
Yes.
It's on the corner.
Yeah, I'll give a diagram of the relevant energy scale. So this energy is an EV, or say 10 to the 15 hertz. This gamma is depends on external parameters, in particular the number density. But if you're operating at 1 bar and take typical collisional cross sections and molecular velocities, this can be a factor of 10 to the 5 slower. So this could be 10 to the 10 hertz at 1 bar, give or take an order of magnitude. So as long as I'm looking on timescales much larger than a nanosecond, I think this is a fair approximation to the absorption rate. Yes, Andy?
You also have to worry about selection rules depending on what the dark matter is, right?
Right.
Photon.
Yes, that's an extremely important point. So if this, it could be that delta H could be the perturbing operator from an axion, in which case this would be CP odd, for example, or it could be CP odd. So if this is a CP even level and this is CP even, then omega zero for this yes, and that's very important. Because the selection rules for this delta H don't need to match those of a normal photon. Yeah. All right. Okay. So why molecules over atoms or solids? We advocate molecules because this is one of those cases where n equals 2 is the perfect mean between 1 and n equals infinity. So atoms have very sparse electronic levels, and they have high thresholds of order a Rydberg. So if you think of this as a hydrogen atom, this is, say, the 1s level, and these are the, say, the 2p levels, px, py, and pz. A diatomic molecule has more electronic levels because it has lower symmetry. So, for example, the p levels are split now depending on whether the angular momentum is aligned with the molecular axis or not. So there's more electronic levels. And furthermore, there's a lot of fine structure now, because now there's vibrational modes of the molecule as well as rotational modes. And famously, in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, there's a nice hierarchy of scales. So I've said this is a Rydberg parametrically. And vibrational levels are about a factor of 30 or so, depending on the reduced mass of the diatomic molecule, smaller. So vibrational splittings are a factor of 30 to 100 smaller. And then there's another hierarchy, yet another factor of 30 to 100 smaller rotational splittings. So here we have a nice resolved discretum of levels and thus potential transition energies, making this a multimode resonator, making a diatomic molecule a multimode resonator, as compared to a solid, which has typically a continuum phonon spectrum and electronic bands, for example, same with liquids. And so having a resolved discretum is nice because you can play tricks with selection rules, and the signal is inherently a narrow band perturbation. So this allows you to be right on resonance and only pick up a dark matter signal and nothing else. And potentially you can tune these levels so you can go on and off resonance and have a lot of control over systematics and backgrounds. So what does it look like? So if you remember the hidden photon, so think of it as a hidden photon dark matter wave as a laser, and it has this enormous density, right? This on a meter-sized sample, it would be like shining a kilowatt laser on your detector, except now there's a small coupling. So here I've picked epsilon, this coupling of 10 to the minus 12, which is experimentally allowed at the moment. And then if you take a simple diatomic molecule like carbon monoxide, it has a vibrational transition from the ground vibrational state to the first excited vibrational state. And so if you stick carbon monoxide in a container of size 10 centimeters or so, smaller, at 100 Kelvin and at 5 bar pressure, it has an electric dipole. It has an absorption rate given by this spectrum here. And so there's not just one line. There's a lot of rotational fine structure here. So the splitting between these two lines is exactly this rotational splitting I've showed on the previous slide. And so, for example, if you're in the first excited rotational state, you can scatter to the first excited vibrational state and zero angular momentum, and you can go to other total angular momentum as well. So you have a uniform comb of transition lines, and it spans roughly 10% or so bandwidth around the main frequency. For example, so this is, for this isotope, the most abundant one, if you did it in carbon monoxide with oxygen 18, then there would be an isotope shift and you'd be sensitive to a different set of transition energies. So in this sense, you can already see it'll be a modular detector because I can switch out different molecules, I can fill my container with a different gas and be sensitive to a different set of transition energies. And of course, this molecule will have other absorption bands at higher energies as well. Okay, so this is what the absorption rate looks like. So for this allowed coupling, I can absorb one photon every 10 seconds, potentially, on resonance. So suppose I see a signal. I want to make sure it's not some stray light or some background. So what I can do is lower the pressure by a factor of 100. So I can go to 50 millibar. And then my absorption rate would, so in the limit of zero molecules, I don't absorb anything. So the absorption rate at a typical frequency is way down by a factor of 10 to the 4 or so. But my on resonance sensitivity is independent of pressure. And so the reason is if you go back here, So on resonance, this Lanczsche factor is 1. And so as I lower the pressure, I naively have less material to absorb on. But if I'm in the regime of collisional broadening, where this is proportional to pressure, so this collisional width is a dominant broadening mechanism, this absorption rate is independent of pressure.
I'll get to that.
And so right now I'm just doing the absorption. We haven't read it out yet. Yeah. Yes.
Oscillation and the absorption rate, as it should be, the sort of finest structure sinusoidal oscillation, does that correspond to different rotational modes or vibrational modes?
Yeah. So, it's a bunch of Lorentzians stacked on top. So this is ground vibrational level, ground rotational level, and a dipole transition can make me jump to the first excited vibrational level, but I always have to absorb in the electric dipole approximation, 1 unit of angular momentum. So the J equals 0 state can go to J equals plus 1. The J equals 1 state here can go to J equals 0 or J equals 2. And 2 can go to 1 and 3, et cetera. So that's what I've indicated here. So for example, the fifth rotational state, J equals 5 in the ground vibrational state, can go to J equals 4. Or it can go to J equals 6. So there's two resonances. In thermal equilibrium, typically, so for carbon monoxide in particular, I occupy the first 10 rotational states here. And then each of those 10 levels can go to 2 different rotational levels in the upper band. So that's why roughly there's, 20 levels. I mean, 20 Lorentzians. Yeah, on that order. Yes?
So what about the absorption rate from the black body photons?
I'll get to that, yes. So at 100 Kelvin, there's still a significant black body tail in this infrared region. That's a background. Yeah, an irreducible background.
In that sense, is it good that you have all these unions of possible energies, or is that a problem? Only one energy, that peak would stick up above.
Yeah. So for example, if I lower the temperature even more, so let's say I do this at 0.05 bar at the same temperature, you see that the width here, the temperature is the same, so this broad width is the same here. But at 0.05 bar, I can go to lower temperatures too, and that means the thermal population will be more peaked, and I'd get fewer peaks. Yeah, or I can use a different molecule with different rotational splittings and have a smaller comb. Yeah, so there's definitely follow-ups you can do with less absorption lines. But in an initial search, you want to cover a wide range of frequencies. Yeah, thank you. Those are excellent questions. OK. So you guys preempted what I was going to talk about next. Before I talk about the experimental setup and the configurations we use, how we read out the background, how we read out the signal, and deal with backgrounds and discriminate against them, I'll first talk a little bit about the challenges or the key things that need to happen in this setup. So the first thing I think someone already asked was frequency coverage. So how do I scan a broad range of energy levels? And the second is, I've shown you the absorption rate, but I want to get a fluorescence photon out, or some type of signal at least. And one way to cover a broad range of frequencies is this collisional broadening of the lines that I've already showed. So as I go to high pressure, the rotational fine structure can be, sorry, the collisional width can be of order the rotational fine structure. I can swap out different molecules and be sensitive to a different bandwidth with each molecule, or even different isotopes of the same molecule. Or at low pressure, I can tune with electric fields. So I can do, I can put the container in an electric field. Not me personally, but someone. And so here I've shown, again, this uniform comb of so this would be the rotational splittings for electric dipole transitions, and normally each J level is degenerate with the projection onto one axis. In an electric field, this is no longer the case. So if I put it in a large enough electric field, instead of just a uniform comb, I can spread these lines, and I can, at high enough fields, I can cover a significant range of the rotational fine structure. So this means that I need to use molecules. If I want to use this method, I need to use molecules with a significant permanent electric dipole moment. In molecule fixed coordinates, yes. The expectation value of the electric dipole moment vanishes. Okay, so yeah, frequency coverage is one key consideration. The second is I need to get photons out, and so this will inspire two different configurations: a bulk experimental setup and a stack experimental setup. I'll explain what that means. And so in the easiest setup, I need to make sure that my radiative width back to the ground state or to intermediate levels is faster, at least of the same order, as the quenching rate. So as my molecules collide, the collision can be inelastic, and some of this internal energy that I've absorbed can go to heat, can go to translational energy of the molecules. So here I've plotted for the same molecule, carbon monoxide, different rates as a function of pressure. So the lifetime of this this particular level, so the first excited vibrational state with zero angular momentum can decay only to this state. So the lifetime of this is roughly 1 second. So it fluoresces at 1 hertz if it's in the excited state. And carbon monoxide quenches, so this level quenches at a very small rate. So this is satisfied in this case, this inequality. So it fluoresces before it gets quenched. But this is a significant problem for electronic levels, which have much higher quenching cross sections. So there, I need to make sure I'm at low enough pressure to make sure I get photons out and not heat. Which is very difficult to see. In a second setup, we use coherence to get the photons out. So in some cases, the radiative width can be enhanced by this dimensionless factor here because of the phase coherence of the dark matter wave, and I'll explain that next. And so in this case, it's possible to have the radiative width be proportional to the pressure, which helps us get a high radiative efficiency. And so, I'll explain that next, don't worry. Are there any other questions about this?
When you say coherent, what do you mean?
So, I'll go okay. Next. Yeah. Way two slides. Yeah. So in the setup that doesn't, so for a normal setup with a bulk volume, that's say 30 centimeters big. There's no coherence effects that I can make use of. So this is my Microsoft Paint picture of the detector setup. So it's just a container filled with diatomic molecules at reasonable pressures, not much above or below 1 bar, lined with reflective coatings and with a sensitive, a large area and low noise photodetector readout. So in an initial phase one prototype, we suggest even using a PMT could be good enough already. And then for phase two prototypes, likely we'd require cryogenic photodetectors or a more advanced technology. So what's the idea? Is that this is an advanced detector simulation. So dark matter comes in, partially excites the molecules, which can then fluoresce, and it'll bounce a couple of times off reflective coatings, and hopefully eventually you'll hit a photodetector and you'll get a single photon count at the edge. How much time do I have? Okay. Yes?
How do you ensure that some other molecule doesn't absorb the
some other molecule?
Yeah, and the photons flying around, can it not?
Yeah, yeah, next also. So there's a possibility that I absorb a dark matter quantum, I can fluoresce a photon, that photon can get subsequently reabsorbed, re-emitted, and then eventually quenched. That's a problem. So you need to make sure that this photon emitted by these guys is optically transparent and that this doesn't happen. But one way this could happen is, for example, if you, in a three-level system, so if you thermally occupy only the ground state and dark matter excites to a second state, one here, and then you fluoresce to some intermediate state two that's not thermally occupied. So this photon will now be this photon will experience very little optical thickness and will escape. So thank you. So this is one way of doing it. So decay fluorescing to a non-occupied intermediate state. A second way of doing it is if dark matter excites forbidden transitions, then a forbidden transition is very unlikely to get, it will have reduced optical thickness and is more likely to escape the detector. Thank you. Okay. I've already said this.
So what kind of dot counts do you need for your photodetectors?
So PMTs can have dark counts on the order of 1 to 0.1 hertz per square centimeters. These ones, it's unclear. It's typically much lower. I think for MKIDs, they've already demonstrated 10 to the minus 2 or to 10 to the minus 3 hertz over centimeter squared size areas. There's room for improvement still. The lower, the better. Yes. But because it's tunable, you can look. Crucially, you can look for signals lower than the dark count rate of the detector, for example. Okay. Just by statistical averaging, for any of them. Because so the energy resolution of the photodetectors is poor compared to the energy resolution of the molecules themselves. Okay. So you can tune the molecules on and off resonance. I think I've already answered a couple of these questions. So I've showed you the absorption rate, but typically there's an efficiency factor for that's less than 1 for getting a signal rate. And this efficiency factor schematically is this radiative efficiency. So what's the probability that I fluoresce? I also have some finite probability of getting absorbed onto the reflective coating. So roughly I can bounce 100 times on a good silver coating or a good dielectric coating, but if I bounce more, I'm likely to get absorbed onto the mirrors at the edge of the container. I've already addressed the optical thickness issue, which you can avoid by doing this fluorescence scheme. So you need to make sure you don't lose a lot in the efficiency factor here. So these PMTs you can buy commercially. They work very well above an EV or so. And Ben Mazin is developing large area MKIDs, and here you see it. He has a photosensitive area. I think this is a 20 kilopixel detector, about the size of a square centimeter, a little bit larger. So this is an American quarter.
What is the subradiation of your MKID?
Microwave kinetic inductance device or detector. So it's basically a mini LC circuit, and if a superconducting or at the superconducting transition. So if a photon hits the inductive element, the inductance changes, and this you can read out via a microwave signal. So each pixel, so on this area, there's 20,000 little LC circuits on them, each at a different frequency. And so there's a microwave feed line somewhere that can read out the phase shift from a single photon hitting one of the pixels. Ben thinks he can scale this up by a factor of 10 linear in size, so 10 by 10 centimeters. Okay, so this is the bulk setup. to, oh, sorry. So I'll give a cartoon derivation of coherence effects. So there's a second setup. Oh, yeah, yeah. So this is, in the distant past, a wise man once said this yesterday. So there's a variety of names for this process, superradiance, superfluorescence, cooperative radiation. But really, it's just a superposition principle. So let me explain why. So let me explain first. So this is the velocity, the probability distribution of the dark matter velocity is like that of a Boltzmann distribution. And it's non-relativistic. So this V, the velocity dispersion, is about 10 to the minus 3. That's actually known to 10%, I think. And this there's also a relative velocity, between the solar system and the dark matter halo, also about 10 to the minus 3. And what this means, that the spread in velocity means that there's a finite phase coherence length in the dark matter wave. So if I compute the correlation function of dark matter here and dark matter there, it's a Gaussian function with a typical length scale that's given by 1 over m or 2 over mv naught. So if I think of an energy of an EV, that's a Compton wavelength of a micron, but the dark matter is coherent, so phase coherent, over a millimeter. Its typical spatial variation is also on the scale of a millimeter, on the same scale as the coherence length. And the wavelength of the photon that comes out is much shorter. Okay.
So this is the issue I was.
Okay. Yes. I planned on this anyway, but yes.
No. The point is that after the atom absorbs the dark matter particle, it gets its momentum.
Right.
And that inverse momentum is like a millimeter. It's very hard, so that you don't localize the atom. Within a millimeter, there is a lot of atoms.
You don't know which atom is excited.
You don't know which one within that millimeter did the absorbing.
Yeah. Okay, so this is my cartoon picture of the container. Let's say I have one molecule in here. Because this, notice here that there's little anisotropy in this velocity distribution. So my dark matter can come in from any direction. If it's a photon, it could have random polarization. So I expect roughly uniform fluorescence, at most maybe a dipole pattern of fluorescence. It doesn't matter so much. So I don't get focusing effects, and the radiative width is, if I ignore intermediate states, just the lifetime of the radiative width in vacuum. Now, if I have a second molecule very nearby, so if it's within one photon wavelength, so within one micron, and at say in the room here, the air has many molecules within a cubic micron. So if it's within one micron, then the phase imprinted by the dark matter wave onto the atom will be the same for both molecules. Just like in Jason's atom interferometer, if he shines a laser on his Bose-Einstein condensate, the phase imprinted onto his atom interferometer is the same. The relative phase between the ground and excited state is the same for all of the molecules, in his case, atoms, here the molecules. What this means is that the atoms radiate in phase. So as Mark said, you add the waves before you square them, and you get four times the power, or the radiative width per molecule is twice that of the width in vacuum, at least for this simple system of two. If I add n, insofar as I can ignore interactions, this would be an n. Okay. Now what happens if they're farther away? So let's say they're farther away, but still within a coherence wavelength, then I get weird directional dependence. So here, in this direction, they still add in phase. But now in this direction, they'll destructively interfere. So now, in general, I get a radiative width that's directionally dependent if I just have two molecules. If I do it here, then I get destructive interference in this direction. So this may lead you to believe that it's a surface effect here, which is true. And if they're far away, so farther than a coherence wavelength, then the phase of this molecule will be uncorrelated with the phase of this one because the phase of dark matter is uncorrelated, and I don't get any coherence effects. Okay, so this is a pictorial derivation of this. We did this exactly using this velocity distribution. What you find is that if your molecules are in a cube, say, or in any rectangular prism, what you find is that the radiative width is exponentially enhanced or hugely enhanced along the normal directions of your surface if it's a rectangular prism. So you like to radiate closely to the normal direction. And so suppose I put a screen, say, here on this side, on this face of the cube, and zoom in around this peak here, then I find an intensity that's emitted in a very narrow cone, and the size of this cone is roughly 10 to the minus 3 radians, or more precisely, this V naught over C times 1 radian, so roughly 3 arc minutes of angle, so it's an extremely tiny cone. And furthermore, it's not exactly the normal direction, but it's a slightly offset from normal, proportional to the velocity of the relative dark matter wind projected onto this plane. So this would mean that if I can achieve this coherence, my signal is focused in a direction I can control because it's just set by the detector geometry. Okay?
You're saying that if I got a big box, and some atoms in the center of the box are going to radiate preferentially in directions associated with the walls of the box.
So I've said it was a surface effect. So if the box goes to infinity, then this factor will become close to one. So I should have said it's a.
Imagine the box is the Broglie wavelength.
Yeah.
But that's not how you're going to do the experiment.
No. Hold on. So what we're imagining for this configuration is a set of slabs. So I said in a bulk container, the effect goes to zero. If the individual slabs are not much larger than a photon wavelength, then each individual slab will have a radiation pattern that's peaked. So imagine if I shrink this direction now, then I have a radiation pattern that's peaked in the normal direction to the slab. The derivation is quite tedious. Forward, yeah. Normal. So if the slab was the board, I would radiate very very close to the normal out of the board.
And this is at a particular frequency mass for dark matter. How do you use the spacing?
Imagine just having one slab. I radiate in the normal direction, and so I can vary the thickness of the slab. Here I've seen it. So here you see. So there's an isotropic part, and then a constructive interference part. This constructive interference part gives me the radiation in this normal direction. As I take the thickness of any one slab to infinity, the constructive interference goes away. And it's because so if I draw a slab, if my slab gets too thick, then this region will destructively interfere with the next half wavelength. So that's why as I take the slab thickness to infinity, this constructive interference part goes away. As long as my thickness is of order the photon wavelength, I can get sizable constructive interference. So that's why we think slab-like geometry is best. And then I can take many of those, and these slabs don't necessarily need to be close together. They could be a coherence wavelength apart or so. as long as they are transparent, I now have a signal, a fluorescence signal that's very close to normal. So I can potentially focus this onto a small area, just like I can focus light coming from the stars, right? It's very close to normal.
And the thickness of this is set by the dark matter, not by the photon.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So right. It's linear. Am I reading that right?
The thickness of each thin slab is the Compton wavelength of the photon. And the thickness of the whole thing can be the one.
Yeah, the transverse size could be as big as you want. It needs to be, to achieve focusing, I need the transverse size to be larger than the coherence wavelength of dark matter, or at least of the same order. So I need large aspect ratio detector geometries that are thin enough. Sorry. Let me just say it again. So I want the thickness to be of order 1 over m, the Compton wavelength of dark matter, and I want the transverse size, let me call this, sorry, can you guys see this? I want the transverse size, I want this transverse size to be larger than 1 over mv naught. And then I achieve this effect.
Is it the thickness of the slab or the spacing of the thin slab?
Forget about the spacing. Think about one slab. I need the thickness to be the Compton wavelength of dark matter, and the transverse size to be larger than the coherence wavelength.
And this restricting the mass range you can now be
seeing? Yeah. Yeah. So, for example, for if I increase the mass by a factor of 10, this radiative width goes down by a factor of 10.
But you just explained that if it's larger than the optical wave,
yes,
then there will be destructive interference.
Some, yes. So, and that's the origin of this suppression here. So I want this to be order 1. So I want the thickness of my slab to be of order the Compton wavelength, at which point this is of order 1. If I make it too thick, eventually I'll lose this part.
You know what's confusing is that
yes.
Picture which we will get to next. It's better to have first discuss once.
Yes, sorry.
Just one
question.
You said you could focus this like starlight, so the text could be very small.
Yes.
But not with flat slabs like that, right? You'd have to go like lens
light. I'm imagining the slabs are made out of a transparent material, like glass or silicon.
You just get a beam. Why do you get focusing?
So you would have to focus it with the parabolic mirror or with a lens.
Yeah, right.
Yes,
that's
yes.
Right.
So you scan over the frequency or the mass of the dark matter by changing the thickness of the slab.
Yeah, so if you have an arrangement of slabs or even just one slab, you would only be sensitive to an order 1 mass range around m. It doesn't need to be exactly matched.
But you want to scan over the mass somehow.
But the whole experiment is sensitive between over 2 orders of magnitude.
Okay.
So I don't need to build 10 to the 4 of these arrangements. I need 3 or 4.
Right.
Yes.
Does having the walls of the slab very close together increase the collisional frequency you need to worry about, or not? Like, or is it wide enough?
Not the collisional frequency.
Okay, that's
no.
Still.
Yeah.
Well, once you start making these slabs thin and you start dropping the pressure, you start really worrying about quenching, that your atom might, sorry, your molecule might hit the wall before
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that was a question. Then that would be a question. Yeah.
You're
flooding with the walls, so.
I think it's still small, but.
Are these slabs of?
I think it's still small.
Slabs of gas? Or are you talking?
Yeah, a hollow slab. A hollow slab filled with gas.
Right, but people are worried about the wall loss.
So silicon is transparent enough, and glass is depending on the frequency. But glass, I mean, we can see through a window. So optical photons have a long attenuation length in glass, and silicon has a very long attenuation length in the infrared. And you need a few other things. If you want a stack of slabs, you would have to have good anti-reflective coatings to make sure you don't reflect off the interfaces. Yeah, so, yeah.
So this is sort of like a super radiance effect.
Yeah, yes. I didn't want to call it that, but yes.
Experimentally,
well,
it would have been seen already.
Unfortunately, we don't have non-relativistic boson waves. sound maybe.
Non-relativistic, and you simulate this somehow with something else?
I mean, so a similar effect has been seen if you take a pencil-like container and you shine a laser onto it, you have primarily fluorescence because of superposition or superradiance, if you want to call it, in the direction of the beam. So I mean, this is exactly the same effect, except now the wavelength of the exciting wave is not the same as that of the fluorescent wave. Yeah. I don't think this has been performed in exactly the same way, but I'm not sure how to reproduce it. I don't think it's been done. Yes?
Also, the claim that you get predominantly perpendicular to the plane is valid after you average over all directions of dark matter incident.
So I've averaged over the full Boltzmann distribution. But yeah, even a single velocity component likes to emit primarily in the normal direction.
What did you claim about laser
shining on a pencil strip? That you can get fluorescence along the direction, primarily along the direction of the exciting laser.
Not just stimulated emission, though. It's not
different. No. It's again because of the superposition. This is a very rich field, but it's because of the superposition principle So a laser going through the atomic sample, say. Will excite the atomic sample over a large volume.
Fluorescence in wavelengths other than the laser.
Sorry, the
fluorescence in wavelengths other than the laser.
No, fluorescence at the wavelength of the laser is primarily along the beam.
Okay,
but that's not called fluorescence, because it's called forward scattering.
Forward scattering. I didn't want to get into semantics, but yes, the superposition principle means that photons come out in the direction along the beam, whether you want to call it scattering, fluorescence. I'm not familiar with all the terms.
But there's no phase matching problem.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what
it's
you mean.
It's not semantics. I'm saying it's not semantics. It's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, maybe we'll talk about
that. Yeah, please. I mean, maybe we're missing something. I don't see it. Okay. How much time do I have? Zero? Okay. I'll go quickly. I swear I'm almost done. So I claim that the coherent radiation can be, so I can have one, for carbon monoxide, I can have 1% of the this coherent fluorescence, or however you want to call it, in the normal direction, in a slack-like setup. So this is for a 30 centimeter slab with a 1 millimeter integrated thickness of all of them. I'll skip this. Sorry, I wanted to talk about backgrounds really quick. You need high reflectivity coatings to make sure you only need a small photosensitive area, and cryogenic photodetectors that are under development for other reasons have achieved very good dark count rates already. Thermal black body background is something you need to, is irreducible and you need to take into account. You can go through pains to reduce the radioactive background by using high purity materials or setting up a veto trigger. We'll specify all of the details in our paper. And one advantage is that in some cases you can emit the signal in a small part of phase space, and the background doesn't do this. And cosmic rays you can have established way of rejecting too. As already been mentioned, you can use, it's a tunable resonator, so you can tune the width by increasing or decreasing the pressure, so you can modulate your absorption rate very naturally. You can scan the line, so you can scan your line shape over the dark matter signal. And you can look for allowed transitions or forbidden transitions where you don't have these handles, or where your signal should do something different than the background. Okay, so what can you do? So for a hidden photon, so this dumb PMT setup in a 30 centimeter detector can already do better than, or is projected to do better on this kinetic mixing parameter above an EV or so. So these are solar cooling bounds, and this is the xenon 10 dark matter experiment where the hidden photon would have ionized the xenon. And then with, I don't have time to explain the shape of these curves, but with this prototype stack setup, this small one, you could have potentially much better sensitivity if you can build low noise photodetectors in the infrared. And then these are some more advanced projections, more optimistic
projections. So what's the exposure for this?
So the exposure is quite small. So as I said, you can be a very low pressure and have the same on resonance signal rate, so then you need to tune the lines. I don't exactly know the numbers off the top of my head, but I think for this one, for example, the stack setup, it was 10 to the minus 4 kilogram per year, times a year. I don't know the numbers. I think it varies across the range too. All right, so as I said, so you can look for different types of transitions. So you can look for B minus L gauge bosons. I think I'm over time. So you can look for light scalars as well. Potentially for nuclear couplings of the QCD axion, as well as electron couplings of the QCD axion, if these phase two experiments are feasible. Okay, so in conclusion, I hope I've convinced you that this is a promising way of looking for bosonic dark matter around the EV scale. There's a lot of things left to be done. You could extend it to lower energy ranges by using colder detectors, potentially higher energies as well, or maybe there's some other use other than resonant absorption. And to map out the types of molecules that are needed to do this broad scan that's also left for future work. It would be interesting to build some phase one prototypes to establish the feasibility of the technology, and also more R&D is needed, especially on the photodetection part, to make these phase two experiments possible. Thank you.
So since we are already over time, maybe like two or three quick questions.
Mike.
So maybe, just thinking right now, maybe one way to imagine this is a kind of a multi-slit interference experiment where you illuminate it coherently and then you have all these interferences.
Exactly. That's my pictorial derivation, right? The two atoms was a double slit, and then the slab you can think of as the limit as you have infinite number of slits. Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
So diffraction theory.
A diffraction grading in some sense. Yes.
Yeah, I just have a short comment. I'm sure you've seen this paper, but as far as I know, the first resonant excitation of two-level system by an axion was considered in the paper by Yannis sometime last century.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and Dima, the Casper experiment is also in some sense excitation of a two-level system by absorbing an axion, right? You excite a nuclear spin down to nuclear spin up. Yeah, I'm not claiming this is the first application of a two-level system. But yeah, so I think it's the first doing vibrational transitions and electronic transitions resonantly. Yeah.
One last question.
Amar?
I have maybe a preface, which is a totally stupid experimentalist kind of question. Is carbon monoxide even a gas at 5 bar and 100 K?
Yes, but at 5.5 bar, it likes to turn into a solid.
What do you mean it's a liquid at 5 bar?
Sorry, at 5.5 bar, it wants to turn into a liquid.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I'm happy about that. Okay. Yes. So the real question is, what are the actual atomic operators to which these things
are? Thank you so much. These. Okay, so I won't explain all of them, but so this is the one I already showed for the hidden photon. You can couple to other currents. Let me just point out one cool one. So this is the same axion wind operator that Dima is looking for. But so at next order in velocity of the atom, actually, not only can you flip the nuclear spin, which is what Dima is looking for, there's transitions that you can induce that flip the nuclear spin and excite a dipole transition onto the spatial wave function of the nucleus. So this operator can excite a vibrational quantum and flip the spin. So it can cause delta V equals 1 as the usual rotational selection rules and can cause a spin singlet to go into a spin triplet. So for example, this operator could excite para-hydrogen to ortho-hydrogen and vice versa, for example. And there's a big list. So scalars can have monopole transitions where you don't have rotational fine structure. So there's a long list. Yeah. Thank you.
Have you thought of detecting solar axions? They will be relativistic this way. But
yeah, so you don't get the resonant enhancement. But maybe if you can build it low.
Why not?
Because the energy is emitted. So the sun's temperature is higher than the mass range that I've shown here. So the spread in energy, the spread in frequency, will be order 1, not 10 to the minus 6 like in this case. So you won't get resonant enhancement in the absorption cross-section. Sorry.
They don't come out of the sun in phase.
No.
They also come out at like...
No, but the dark matter is incoherent too.
Yeah.
So it's a phase different energy.
The xenon bound is I think these are solar sun emitted hidden photons that would have given a signal in xenon 10, and this is a dark matter result. Yeah. Any more questions?
Okay. So that's the same.